next week to bring mine here, so you have to show me. With the establishment of the state in 1948 and the subsequent victory over the Arab armies that ended with the armistice agreements in 1949, the State of Israel faced very many great problems. It was a nascent state that just had come into being, and it really you have to learn how to become a state after not having a national entity for almost 2,000 years. The first main problem dealt with the fact that you had hundreds of thousands of Jews that wanted to come or had no other choice but to come to the State of Israel. So you had to be able to absorb them somehow. And the entire Jewish population of the state at the time of the 1948 war was 600,000 people. A little more than what the population of Yerushalayim is today. And this posed a tremendous problem. Social, economic, infrastructure, everything. there were 100,000 Jews, over 100,000 Jews that were interned in Cyprus, in the British internment camps in Cyprus. And from 1947 on, the British intercepted ships carrying illegal immigrants to the land of Israel. And the people on those ships were taken to Cyprus, which then was a British colony. And they were interned in British camps, internment camps. Not necessarily under cruel conditions, but not necessarily under benign conditions either. With the establishment of the state, the British had no longer any reason to hold them there. So the state of Israel, so to speak, imported them. So you had, in one shot, a sixth of the population of the state of Israel come in. Then there are still large numbers of Jews that were in Europe. Displaced persons, they were called. Refugees. Survivors of the Nazi camps and of the Second World War. The United States accepted, relatively speaking, very few. There were strict immigration quotas, and the State Department, which had to issue the visas, was never sympathetic to allowing Jews into the United States. That was Ernest Bevin's famous sardonic statement when Truman asked England to allow 100,000 Jews to come into the land of Israel. He said he wants them here because he doesn't want them in Brooklyn. And the truth of the matter is that to obtain permission to come to the United States was a very difficult matter. And the Jews that were trapped in Europe, the overwhelming majority wanted to go to the land of Israel. So you had another tremendous wave of immigration, influx of people who in fact, Israel's going to double its population in 2 years. You then had the fact that when the state of Israel came into being, the Muslim countries where Jews had lived for centuries took revenge upon their Jewish population for the establishment of the state of Israel by expelling them. So you had the immigration from Yemen and from Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, Iraq, Iran as well, Lebanon, Syria. These were places of ancient Jewish communities. Community in Iran dated back to the time of Purim. Community in Iraq dated back to the end of the First Temple. The communities in North Africa dated back to the Roman Empire. And there was a set Jewish life there, a very traditional Jewish life. And And now these people were expelled. Maybe we get some more chairs from somewhere in the office. That's here. Eventually, over 600,000 Sephardic Jews who had come to the land of Israel in a relatively short period of time. And they would come practically penniless, because the Muslim countries, when they expelled them, confiscated their wealth, their property, whatever they had. But most of them left only with literally the shirt on their back. And that's the statement that you hear every once in a while, that when they don't have any. When the Arabs demand reparations, compensation for properties that they lost here in the land of Israel in the wars, there can be a counterclaim, which in the world is never quite mentioned, for all of the properties that the Jews, especially the Sephardim, lost in the Arab countries where they had resided. So you have this enormous problem that doubling and more than doubling the population in 3-4 years. So the first question is, where do you put them? So temporarily, at least, all of the Arab housing that was abandoned in cities like Jaffa, Haifa, here in Jerusalem, for instance, the Katamon neighborhoods here, people just moved in. That absorbed part of this influx of people, but it certainly couldn't absorb them all. So the Israeli government created a system called Ma'barot. Ma'barot meant camps transition, where you were going to be for a little while until they found or built housing. Well, the definition of a little while varied greatly. But for most of them, it was a minimum of 2 years. For many, it was as long as 6 or 7 years. And the conditions in the Ma'barot were, phrase it kindly, were primitive. The sanitation was minimal. People lived in tents. Eventually they built like little huts for themselves, Quonset huts. No sidewalks, no streets. It was like the refugee camps looked. There was a lot of squalor, a lot of difficulty. And these people were now mainly on the dole, because they had no way to earn a living. And that created a mentality, a certain class, especially of the older generation, that did not leave positive images for the next generation. And especially in the Sephardic world, where respect for parents and respect for the previous generations was an integral part of their culture, that was destroyed here. It's slowly being rebuilt by its political parties. But then it was literally destroyed, because the younger generation saw their parents as it's always a problem of the immigrant generation, that the immigrant generation, which doesn't speak the language well and is not acquainted with the country, in the eyes of their children, are diminished. They become irrelevant. That happened in the United States, happened in England, happened throughout the world. And it happened here too. And you have here a second factor which is very insidious, is that the people who ran the Maabarot, and especially the government, was a labor, socialist, Zionist, anti-religious government. And to them, the method of incorporating the immigrants into the country was to secularize them. So we have all the famous pictures of the peyote, of the children being cut off, secular teachers, secular schools, a whole secular environment, which further distanced the generations one from another, and which began really the great secular religious rift which exists in the country till today. During the War of Independence, there was a show of unity that had never been seen before. And as I mentioned, even the anti-Zionist religious parties that joined the Israeli government were in the cabinet. There was a chance really to unify the country then. But after the forced secularization of really hundreds of thousands, then the bitterness set in, a bitterness which still prevails until today. So this great problem of what to do with the immigrants really wasn't solved until the next generation. The immigrant generation itself, to a great extent, did not accommodate itself. Found it very difficult. Ben-Gurion had this idea of building what he called Ore Pituach, development towns. Now the development towns were really towns, Jewish enclaves, that were built on the borders of the country to protect the borders. People protect the borders better than fences or security measures, something which the present government is blind to. Ben-Gurion said the solution is to put people on the borders, and he did. He built development towns all over the country, roughly coinciding with the borders of the State of Israel or the open areas. And he took the immigrants and he put them in those towns. But some of those towns have become very successful. Some of them still are really disaster areas. You have towns in the Negev, Netivot, and Yerucham that are not at all what they should be. And you have a place like Arad, for instance, which grew into a big city and has its own, of course, putting the nuclear reactor there helped it, because it provided an economy and jobs. And all over the Galil you have these development towns. You had the Kiryat Shmona on the Lebanese border, which has taken its share of grief. And people were thrown into these towns. Many times they were thrown in disparate groups. Migdal HaEmek, you know, they had Romanians and Sephardim, right? And it was oil and water, didn't mix. And you have, for the first time in Israel, really a problem of crime. Not the type of crime that we unfortunately have today, which is much more prevalent. And today we have organized crime. But physical crime, crime person on person, was almost unknown. Not only on that was almost unknown, I knew my aunt's house in Tel Aviv where she never locked the door. I have to put it into context, when I was a rabbi in Miami Beach, we also never locked the door. Never locked the car, never locked the door. But we've come a long way since then, baby. My children still remember that we didn't lock the door. My grandchildren don't believe us. But here, people never lock the door. And in the early 1970s, when the question of organized crime here in Israel began to surface, so one of the great wits in the Knesset, Dr. Berg, got up and he said, there is nothing in Israel is organized, so how can there be organized crime? But the Israeli mafia is a very, very strong and prevalent force today. A lot of this occurred simply because of the breakdown between the generations and the problems of immigration. The same thing happened in the United States. Organized crime on a major scale was a product of the Irish and Italian and Jewish immigrants who could not find a different way to survive and therefore made crime a business. So that was one enormous problem, and that problem, in our time, for instance, the Russian immigration, which occurred 15 years ago, etc., had been very successful. They learned the language, integrated themselves in the country, people with skills, they found themselves pretty much right away. Probably the most successful integration of a large number of people. Don't forget, you've got a million people coming into a population then of about 4.5 million. So it's 25% almost. But that one worked. There are others that have been far less successful. The Ethiopian immigration has had a hard time coping. I mean, the problems there are many. One of the problems is that it's really an integration of people from the 15th century into the 20th or 21st century. I remember I once spoke 10 years ago to an Ethiopian young man, and I said to him, you know, he came on this plane, Operation Moses, and I said to him, that probably was the first time in your life you ever saw an airplane up close, which was a stupid statement to make, but sometimes I do it. And he said, an airplane, that's the first time we ever saw stairs. And when he had ladders, he said, no, never had stairs. So that hit me. I had an aunt of mine in the 1950s who was a social worker in the Ma'barot. And in the Ma'barot where she worked, they finally installed running water in the houses, flush toilets. So she said the people kept their fish in the toilet and they dug latrines in the back, because that was their, that's the way it was. And she said it would be, it's almost impossible to get them to change. So you have this tremendous problem. And you also have the problem, Ashkenazim and the Sephardim did not get along, the history of that in the land of Israel for a long time, way before Zionism. And because of all of this, a lot of bitterness was stored up in the country. When the Russians came, so then great benefits were offered to them, New Olim, housing, helping find a job. And there were great mutterings amongst the Sephardim that, you know, when we came 30 years ago, you didn't do anything for us. And now, because they're Ashkenazim, they're Russians, you know, you're giving them everything. Which is not an accurate statement, but it reflects, as I said, the bitterness that still remained generations after the event. That's why you have ethnic parties in Israel. I'm not talking about religious parties, I'm talking about ethnic parties. A party like Shas is basically an ethnic party. A party like Lieberman's party is basically an ethnic party. These are parties that are based upon ethnic groupings and nationalities, not upon necessarily ideologies. Second great problem, which is tied into the first problem, is the economy. How do you float the ship? So you're talking about a socialist government, very committed socialist government. Talking about the very, very powerful labor union that is the government. It's not a separate entity. And therefore, the solution was draconian taxes. Tax system which until today remains draconian.
What's that?
It means that out of every dollar that you make, out of every shekel that you make, 56% goes in taxes, with very few deductions allowed. You have an economy where the government is the largest, was then certainly the largest employer in the country. Everybody's working for the government, which is very inefficient. And you had an economy where the government demanded control over every major company and industry. The government owned the banks. We're just now coming to the end of that period of time when the banking industry is being privatized in Israel. So Hapoalim was privatized, now Bank Leumi was privatized. Discount Bank was privatized, to the shouts of dismay of many people, because of the fact that the bureaucracy is always overstaffed and it's always inefficient, and the people are the one that pays for it. And they sold Bezek. You couldn't get a telephone in Israel. Could not get a telephone in Israel till the early 1990s. You had to wait a year, 2 years, 3 years to get a telephone. Why? Because they didn't want to give you a telephone. That simple. what broke the telephone problem was in 1979 when Anwar Sadat visited Jerusalem. So there was an influx of like 5,000 or 8,000 foreign correspondents at one time. And everybody needed a telephone to communicate. And in 3 days, they put in 8,000 telephones. After saying all the time to the Israeli public, well, it can't be done. It takes 2 years to get a telephone. We got to put in the wire. We got to figure out the number. So you don't realize the revolution that's involved here. I remember that as late as the early 1970s, when we wanted to talk to my aunt in Tel Aviv, we had to call the neighbor down the block and tell her to go get my aunt and that we'd call back in 10 minutes. Because who had a telephone? And the government controlled the telephones. An interesting thing happened when television came. The government and Ben-Gurion opposed television. Politics makes for strange bedfellows. You have Ben-Gurion and the Haredim opposed television. Ben-Gurion opposed it for two reasons. One visible and one invisible. The visible one is that he said that there's nothing good on television to watch. A comment which still probably has much truth to it today. Except for my 3 television hours in the week, is very little to watch. But the secret reason, the non-revealed reason, was that once you had television, you know, like the cat was out of the bag, right? Then you couldn't control the minds of the people. Television's a very, very powerful weapon. And sooner or later, ideas will come out of it that the government or that the ruling parties will not like. And people will see it and respond to it. And in spite of everything that they said, that they had a free press and everything, and the definition of free was always up for discussion. If you said what the government wanted you to say, then you could write whatever you wanted. But if you were against the government, then there were all sorts of bureaucratic ways that somehow the paper, the broadcast never got, and still exists today, by the way. I mean, I can only tell you in my experience. We made a film about Rashi that was on Israeli television a number of times, but we couldn't go on the government channel, even though they're supposed to show religion, you know, a certain portion of the time is supposed to be, because as the woman in charge told me, it is too Jewish. So, you know, so that's a form of censorship that's imposed by people who have a certain ideology, and they're the gatekeepers. Well, today with cable and with direct access, etc., and today what has really freed it up is the internet. The fact that on the internet you can get anything, good, bad, or indifferent. And so that's it. So today you do have a great deal of freedom of information, which you never had at the beginning of the state. The economy here, because of this, and because of the fact that it was coming out of nothing, you had to create it from nothing, was pretty much in shambles. The government didn't have money, even if you took all the tax monies. And aside from the prohibitively high income tax, there also is a high sales tax, a VAT. Today it's 16.5% on everything, except food. But, you know, if a plumber comes to your house, you've got to add 16.5% to the bill. This is how the government makes money. Now, import duties, customs taxes. There was a long period of time when you had to pay an airport tax in this country. When leaving the country, you had to pay a tax leaving and you had to pay a tax going. Today, the airport taxes are swallowed into the tickets, so you're not really aware of it. But there still is a very high airport tax. I looked at my ticket, it was $28.10 a person on a flight to New York. Well, figure out how many people are flying to New York at $28.10, and then pretty soon you're talking about money. So there were all ingenious ways to extract money from the people. All of which led to two problems: a permanent recession in the country, they called a mitoon, because nobody had money to buy anything. And there was really nothing to buy, by the way. As late as 1955, my father of blessed memory came to visit my grandmother of blessed memory here, and he brought her as a gift from the plane a hard-boiled egg and an apple, because you couldn't get an apple and eggs were rationed. Now, when you walk into a supermarket in Israel today, or you walk into your local vegetable and fruit store, you have to remember there wasn't a tomato in the country till 1969. Moshe Dayan was the Minister of Agriculture then, and he encouraged the planting of tomatoes. So the first year's tomatoes were small, green, and hard. And the Jewish people called them Meshelach, in honor of Moshe Dayan. But today, the tomatoes are tomatoes. Yes?
48, 49, 50. Where was Israel sourcing food from?
So let me explain that. The main source of food, believe it or not, came from companies in the United States. That what happened was that they got food. America has always been generous. So they had what was called care packages. I don't know if anybody here remembers that thing. But there still are. You can ship to Africa today, to underdeveloped countries. So they'll sell you a package for $10 that'll contain a month's worth of the basic foods that a person needs. But the people don't have the $10. So what happened is that there were companies that were set up in the United States that you bought scrip from them. You gave them $12 or $15, and they gave you a $10 certificate. You sent the $10 certificate to your relative in Israel. He went to the warehouse in Tel Aviv or in Jerusalem with the certificate, and they gave him the box that had food for a month. I remember for years my father supported the family here in Israel with these certificates. I remember I once wanted to buy something, etc. My mother told me we can't afford it because we have to send the certificate to the grandmother, right? Otherwise she won't have what to eat. So this was one method. But there were a lot of people that didn't have relatives in the United States. So they were supported by the government. Where did the government get the money? From the taxes. But the government ran at a tremendous deficit. So the government had to borrow money. And again, America was generous. It lent money to Israel. On the last time was when the Russian immigration came. So President Bush, the elder President Bush, lent Israel $10 billion to help absorb the refugees. The guy, America didn't lend the money. What they did is guaranteed the loan. And then they went to banks all over the world with the American government's guarantee and able to borrow money at a reasonable rate of interest, which they repay. So now a new thing happened. Prime Minister of Germany.
Sir, what's America's reason for helping Israel? If they weren't going to take any Jews and force them, or why should it be?
America's very, it's a very ambivalent attitude. America is Israel's greatest friend, and the one that really can't be trusted at the same time. And it's always been like that. No, I don't think so. They're outposts in the Middle East or Saudi Arabia. They don't need us.
There's a big Jewish voting public.
Well, that's also a perception, but not a reality. There are more Muslims in America than Jews.
But there weren't
at that time. That's true. But still, the Jews were not a major voting factor, except in two or three states. The influence of the Jews was then as now. Contributing to campaigns, being political activists, etc. But it's not why America should be more friendly to Israel than, let's say, France or England. There's no clear reason why. But it just is, thank God. Now, the German premier was a man, prime minister was a man by the name of Konrad Adenauer. Adenauer was an anti-Nazi. During the war, was interned by the Nazis in prison. He became the head of West Germany. Germany was divided originally into four occupation zones, British, French, American, and Russian. Cold War began by 1950. It was in full bloom. So the Russians created a puppet state, East Germany, which they called the German Democratic Republic. The communists always took the high road. They were the democratic, they were the progressive, they were the liberal, they were the peace lovers. And the Americans and the French and the British united their three zones, and they created the Federal Republic of Germany, which was larger than East Germany. And the city of Berlin was divided into the Russian zone, but until 1960 there was free access. You could walk across. The Western allies, especially the United States mainly, poured billions into West Germany to rebuild it. Rebuilt its industry, rebuilt its economy so that it became the strongest economy in Europe. Adenauer was a very astute politician, and he was a person of conscience too. And he entered into negotiations with then it was Dr. Nachum Goldman, who was the president of the World Jewish Congress, and he entered into negotiations for reparations, that Germany would pay reparations to the Jewish people for what it had done during the Holocaust. The reparations were divided in two parts. One was for the state of Israel as a state, and the second was for individuals who had been suffered under the Nazis. Goldman negotiated this agreement. It was great. Emotional turmoil whether or not the agreement should be accepted or not. Menachem Begin opposed it with all of his might and oratory. About 40% of the Knesset opposed it. Begin was so vehement about it that he was expelled for 3 months from the Knesset. Begin and Ben-Gurion never got along. This didn't help it. Ben-Gurion never called Begin by his name. He would say the gentleman sitting next to Mr. Goldberg when he would recognize him in Parliament. But eventually the Knesset agreed and ratified the reparations agreement. Now the reparations agreement built the infrastructure of Israeli industry. The Germans built the railroads here, they built the ports, the electric company. Great deal of the steel plant, great deal of the industrial infrastructure of Israel was because of German reparations. For years in Israel, and that still remains today, you could buy a Mercedes at a big discount, cheaper than you could in the United States. But Israel, because of its tax structure, so when you buy a car here, you're paying twice the price because 60% of it are taxes to the government. That's why, you know, the car that you can buy in the United States for $20,000 costs $45,000 there. But German industry, which was rebuilt by the Americans, helped rebuild, or helped build the industry in the country here. It also provided income to hundreds of thousands of refugees from Europe who were able to prove, either by the number on their arm or through other methods, and the Germans were quite liberal. In the 50s. The Germans were quite liberal in allowing the reparation claims. And there were many people who simply lived on the reparations money that they got every month. The number diminishes now naturally because as that generation departs from us. But even now, the Germans spend billions of marks every year on reparations. And in Europe itself, in the European Union, Germany is Israel's strongest supporter and ally. So that was a second area where they were able to build up the country, to build it up from reparations. He was brutally frank about it, Ben-Gurion. He said that this, in no way this should be seen as forgiveness or even forgetting, but that it has to be seen as a practical way to build the Jewish state. Who else is going to do it for us? Who else is going to give us this kind of money? Who else is going to, you know, give us the railroad cars and everything else? The third area of money was Israel bonds. Beginning in 1952, Ben-Gurion came up with the idea of selling bonds all over the world. Initially to Jews, and that the bond would carry a rate of interest. All Israel bonds have a hetziriska, by the way, which allow the interest, as do all Israeli banks. And be a 15-year bond, and Israel would pay it off. I remember in 1952, when Ben-Gurion came to Chicago, he came by himself to America to kick it off. I remember in Chicago, he spoke at the Sherman Hotel. If you bought, and that was a lot of money then, if you bought a $1,000 bond, you know, you had the right to shake his hand. And there were people, you know, the line went around the block. I remember my Rebbe Mendel, Zecher Tzadik Levrocha, Mendel Kaplan, who was not a Zionist, but who was a lover of Jews. So he went, we went down there to just to see the thing. We didn't have $1,000 to shake his hand. And he commented to us, he said, look at the children of our father Abraham who stand in line to spend, to give away money. And they sold bonds in a small denomination as $100. I remember we bought my family bought a $100 bond. Now, I don't say everybody, but I would say 90% of the people who bought the bonds thought it was a donation. They're never going to pay back. Come to 15 years, they'll say, oh, you know, we don't have the money, and it's in the state of Israel, and you're Jewish, and, you know, whatever. But they've repaid every penny with interest. And after a while, they became so successful that many non-Jewish institutions, labor unions, colleges, etc., bought the bonds for their pension funds. And it's $3 or $4 billion a year, even today. I remember we took off a Sunday from the yeshiva. It was a big controversy in the yeshiva whether we were allowed to do it or not. But the majority of the rabbeim against the minority of the rabbeim, and the majority said that we should go out. And so we went door to door to sell bonds, the $100 bonds in our neighborhood, right? Poor Jews, you know, I remember collecting money, not just in bills. First of all, not everybody had a checking account then. 1952, most people in America did not have a checking account. And people didn't pay in bills. I mean, they paid us in pennies. But they scraped together all the, everything they had in the shoebox to give you $100. Gave a tremendous psychological boost because you felt you were doing something. And it cut across all lines. I mean, the anti-Zionists also bought the bonds.
So how
did they have the interest? Well, it was not that, well, pardon, they have an agreement with Chase Manhattan Bank in New York, that's their agent. I mean, it has been the largest, most successful sale of foreign bonds in the history of the United States.
Why the anti-Zionists buy the bonds?
Because you wanted to help Jews and you wanted to help Eretz Israel. There was a long period of time when people did not differentiate between the state of Israel and the land of Israel. So even if you didn't like who was running the state of Israel, and even if you didn't agree with their policies, but you still had an attachment to the land of Israel, and this was helping the land of Israel. It's only since we've become more prosperous and numerous and everything else that we can afford to make those differences. There were those, for instance, in the reform movement in the United States, there were many temples that refused to allow an appeal for Israel bonds. Until the Six-Day War changed all of that, too. When we get to, we'll talk about it. The Six-Day War converted Reform to Zionism. But as late as the early 1960s, I remember places that would not allow it because they said, we shouldn't be supporting a foreign country. But basically, to rank and file the Jew on the street, he came up with the money. I remember my years being the rabbi in Miami Beach, so the Israel Bond dinner always kicked off in January in Miami Beach at the Fontainebleau Hotel with like 4,000 or 5,000 people in attendance at the banquet. They always sent over some big people from Israel. I remember one year I gave the invocation, and Yitzhak Rabin and Yigal Alon were there. I sat next to him on the dais. So I gave the invocation, and once in a while I do something well. About every 30 years is a cycle. And so I didn't give the bland invocation, I gave a 3-minute invocation that said everything about the state of Israel and about the Jewish people. When I sat down, so Alon said to Rabin in a stage whisper, he said, "We should have rabbis like that in Israel." And Rabin looked at him and responded, "Yesh lonu maspik. We've got enough rabbis in Israel. We don't need any more." But at that Bond dinner, they raised $100 million. I mean, it just was wild. I remember the man who made the appeal, who was a Reform rabbi, wonderful man, and he was my neighbor. His temple was kitty corner from my shul in Miami Beach. And I had a lot to do with him regarding many matters. We liked each other. And he made the appeal. And he was terrific. When the appeal was all over and I had like the $100 million, he said, "Now I'm going to auction off my cufflinks. Who, $50,000 bond? You can have my cufflinks." Guy stands up and he gives him $50,000. He took off his jacket, his tie, his shirt. So when it was all over, I said to him, "Rabbi, it's too bad you don't wear tzitzis." Could have made another 50. But, that was it. That was the religion was to buy Israel bonds. That was the mitzvah saseh. Was the positive commandment that you had to do. And so there was a sizable amount of money. And Israel used the money to build the rest of its infrastructure. The water carrier from Tiberias, the Movilo Artsi, which comes all the way down and waters all of Israel, that was built with Israel bond money. The highways, able to fix the airport, buy planes, all of these, because this is all big money. And where do you have the money to do it? You can barely pay the janitor who's cleaning your office. So you want to build this $1 billion project. Or the nuclear reactor, that didn't come free. So Israel bonds was and is one of the great sources for capital money. Not for maintenance money, but for capital money. And they were clever enough, if that's the word, to be able to subdivide these things. So for instance, the JNF, Jewish National Fund, they took over agriculture. All agricultural projects in Israel were not done by the government, they were done by the JNF, planting the forests, making the roads, building the parks, biotech research. So that was a different schnorr, right? So that wasn't Israel bonds or the Israel, that was JNF. So they had all of these agencies, so to speak, each one undertaking different projects, which in a, quote, normal, unquote, country, the government would be responsible for. In the United States, the Forestry Service is part of the government. It's part of the Department of Interior. In Israel, there is no Forestry Service. It's the JNF. It has nothing to do with the government. Or You want the ambulance services, Magen Dovid Adom? That's another separate thing. You go and schnorr the ambulances. So every ambulance in Israel's got the name of a donor on it. But that's how the country was built. Yes, sir.
So around the world, how many observant communities were fighting against this?
Nobody fought against it. The Orthodox synagogues always had Israel bond appeals, even the ones that did not have appeals for the United Jewish Appeal, because they objected to the money, the way the federations were spending it. But Israel bonds almost every Orthodox congregation, shtiebels, everybody had to pay. Everybody was part of Israel bonds. And the Israel bonds, they had a wonderful thing for a long time that you could bring, if you went on a tour to Israel to visit, you brought the bond, they would cash it for you before the 15 years here, and then you could use the money here, and that's how you financed your trip.
The people who believed in waiting for Mashiach.
Yeah, but Mashiach is Mashiach, but bonds are bonds, right? You know what? It's not contradictory, and it's not ideologically contradictory. People saw that this was a way to help their relatives. I mean, the Jews always felt that way, you know. Even today, the bottom line is that you're helping your cousin. What are you going to do? Maybe you don't like everything he says or what he does, but he's your cousin. So then you have this obligation of familial national responsibility. So these were the three methods by which capital funds were raised, which naturally spilled over into the economy, because if you're building roads and you're building forests and you're building this, people have jobs, you got to order material, it's a whole thing, and therefore that kept the ball rolling. Yeah?
So to go back to Menachem Begin, if he didn't want to do reparations, what was his other options?
He didn't say what his other options were. He just emotionally, I think the difference was that he was in Poland and Ben-Gurion wasn't in Poland in World War II. A different emotional reaction. I think then looking back, we have to say that Ben-Gurion was right on the matter. That even though we would have felt good to be able to say to Adenauer, nine, in the long run, Israel benefited greatly from the fact that it said, yeah. Okay, good.
Do you want to send that, David? Please.